Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise and give you the concentrated insight from the most important research happening right now. I'm Alex Sagan.
And I'm Sam Fleming, ready to break down a week that spanned everything from, well, ancient history and planetary tipping points to the very building blocks of life. It's quite a range.
That's right. Our deep dive today is into the collection of sources gathered under the title Live Science for the week of October 4th, 25.
And our mission for you, the listener, is really to distill the week's most important scientific insights and, importantly, their implications.
Yeah, we've got a monumental amount of material. I mean, primatology, deep space, synthetic biology, collapsing climate systems. It's a lot.
It's a massive week, definitely. So let's just jump right into the content.
Okay. Well, we really have to begin by acknowledging a huge moment in science history this week, the passing of really one of the 20th century's most revered scientific figures.
We are referring, of course, to the famed primatologist and conservationist Jane Goodall. She died peacefully on Wednesday, October 1st. She was 91.
Her impact is just foundational, isn't it? And it's important to remember, you know, when she first arrived at Gombe Stream National Park back in Tanzania in 1960, she had almost no formal academic training.
None at all. Yet her methodology, which was all about patience, empathy, and just deep observational care, it immediately started overturning established scientific dogma.
In a field that was, let's be honest, pretty rigid, very anthropocentric at the time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And her first revolutionary step was just her approach to the animals themselves, habituation, getting them used to her presence.
Right. She established that routine that's now standard across animal behavioral research globally, hasn't she? Getting wild animals to trust human presence enough so they behave naturally.
Exactly. So you get true insight into their private, complex lives.
And that trust led almost immediately to one of the most transformative discoveries, tool use.
Yeah, October 1960. She observed a male chimp. She named him David Graybeard, carefully stripping leaves off a stick.
And then poking it into a termite mound, right, to fish them out?
Pretty much, fishing for termites. It sounds simple now, maybe, but the scientific world was absolutely stunned.
Stunned because, well, it demolished the definition of humanity as the only tool maker, didn't it?
Completely. It prompted paleoanthropologist Louis Leakey's famous line, you know, "We must now redefine tool, redefine man, or accept chimpanzees as human."
Wow, that's a heavy quote. It really forced humanity to reconsider its unique place.
It was a total paradigm shift. But beyond tools, Goodall also just defied the conventional wisdom of the time.
Yeah.
You know, treating study subjects like clinical numbers.
She gave them names. Flo, Fifi, Goliath.
Which, again, sounds normal now, but it was revolutionary. It established this idea that each chimpanzee has a unique individual personality.
And that wasn't just charming, was it? It actually paved the way for serious research into personality science.
Exactly. How individual temperaments, cautious, bold, would ever influence behavior, social rank, survival, reproduction, personality as a real factor in evolution.
And her focus on individuals extended to family life too, didn't it? Mother-infant relationships.
Oh, definitely. She observed detailed weaning tactics, mothers denying nursing as infants got older, but also, crucially, mothers exposing infants to social interactions, teaching them.
Teaching them things like tool use.
Yes. We now know mothers are essential teachers. There are observations of mothers literally handing down stick tools to their young, showing them the right angle, the technique for termite fishing.
That's incredible. Generational transmission of learned behavior. Culture, essentially.
It's a cornerstone of cultural evolution in primates. And their bonds weren't just family. Goodall documented strong, long-term social connections beyond kin.
Like sharing food with buddies, complex alliances. That takes serious cognitive power, social memory especially.
The social memory is exceptional. Later research confirmed that chimps recognize former groupmates, even rivals, decades after separation.
Wow.
Yeah. And that social tolerance based on memory and recognizing personalities is fundamental. It allowed their societies to become complex enough for cultural evolution, like passing down tool skills.
But she didn't shy away from the darker side either. She was the first to document systematic violence.
Right, including dominant females killing the young of others, probably to reduce competition, and, disturbingly, long-running violence between groups, essentially warfare, border patrols.
Calculated territorial warfare.
Yeah. It revealed a critical truth about our closest relatives. They have this capacity for deep collaboration and empathy, but also for calculated brutality and conflict. Her work spanned the full spectrum.
Challenging that simple human-animal dichotomy. and ultimately driving modern conservation.
A powerful, complex legacy.
Absolutely. And it leads us, actually, quite directly to the evolving ethical landscape around intelligence today, moving from biological intelligence in chimps to artificial intelligence. The issues of manipulation and trust are really converging, aren't they?
They absolutely are. Let's talk about a major, immediate threat in the digital realm, deepfake audio. There's a new study showing voice cloning has hit a critical point.
Meaning
the average listener just cannot accurately tell the difference between a real human voice and an AI-generated clone anymore.
That's a huge shift. And the numbers are terrifying, right?
They are. So generic AI voices made from scratch, people misidentify them as human about 41% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But voices that were cloned from a specific person.
The deepfakes.
Right. They were misclassified as human 58% of the time. That's statistically damning. Cloned voices are basically indistinguishable to the average ear now.
The implications are just profound for security, ethics, politics.
Oh, absolutely. And we're seeing immediate criminal uses. The sources mentioned that $15,000 scam against Sharon Brightwell, convinced by a deepfake clone of her daughter's voice crying, needing money after an accident.
That's horrifying. The emotional manipulation just bypasses rational thought.
Exactly. And politically. Imagine faking statements from leaders. We saw that example with the clone of Queensland Premier Stephen Miles' voice pushing a Bitcoin scam.
And what makes it so overwhelming isn't just the quality, it's how easy it is now.
That's the killer point. The tech sophistication isn't the bottleneck anymore. The clones in that study, not made by state actors, they used commercially available software.
Minimal expertise needed.
Minimal expertise, and chillingly, as little as 4 minutes of someone's speech to train the clone. 4 minutes.
Wow. So the ability to create incredibly deceptive audio is basically available to anyone.
Pretty much anyone with a computer and a recording. Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of tech paradigm shifts, let's jump back in time a bit. A key science history moment. October 3rd, 1950, the patent for the three-electrode circuit element.
The transistor. The device that powers literally everything digital we use.
And it came out of a desperate need, right? Before that, it was all vacuum tubes.
Triodes, yeah. The backbone of telecoms, early computers. AT&T used them for amplifying signals, but they were huge power hogs. Notoriously unreliable, generated massive heat, short lifespans.
Bell Labs needed something solid state, smaller, more durable.
Desperately. And the breakthrough came from William Shockley, John Bardeen, and Walter Brann. Their first point contact transistor worked, but it was tricky.
Shockley improved it later with the junction transistor.
Right. The junction transistor was more robust, became the template. They snagged the Nobel Prize in 56 for it.
And the key was stability and scale, wasn't it? A tiny, reliable, low-power on-off switch.
Exactly. While it amplified signals, its real game changer was computing, replacing those bulky, hot vacuum tubes. That miniaturization paved the way for Moore's Law, the whole digital era.
And now, fast forward, AI is demanding so much power, we're hitting another heat problem, just on a micro scale. Which brings us to Microsoft's liquid-cooled chips.
Yeah, the sheer density of modern GPUs, these AI processors, they generate heat that standard cooling, even fancy cold plates, just can't keep up with. Data centers risk maxing out their thermal limits soon.
Throttling performance. So their solution is microfluidics. They're actually etching tiny grooves, like microscopic pipes, directly into the silicon chip itself.
Right into the die. It closes the thermal gap. Instead of layers between the hot silicon and the coolant flows through the silicon. Direct contact.
And that removes heat much more effectively.
Up to 3 times more effectively than cold plates, according to their research.
And the design is interesting, too. Inspired by nature. Leaf veins, butterfly wings.
That's right. Biomimetic designs. They optimize how the liquid spreads, making sure it hits the hot spots efficiently. In tests, it cut the peak temperature rise in the silicon by a staggering 65%.
65%? That's huge. Not just for safety, but performance, too. Allows for overclocking.
Potentially, yes. If you control the heat, you can push the chips harder, run them faster. Essential for those intense, unpredictable AI training workloads.
Okay, so from the overheating hardware brain of AI, let's pivot to the, well, complex and slightly chilling ethics around simulated consciousness. LeBroned mini brains.
Cerebral organoids, yeah. And the advanced versions, assembloids, where they fuse different organoid types to mimic connections between brain regions.
Raising the theoretical possibility they could become conscious.
That's the potential dilemma. If they become conscious, is it ethical to experiment on them? A public poll showed deep uncertainty. About 23% said there's just no ethical way to experiment on conscious organoids, period.
But there wasn't consensus, was there?
No. 25% were okay using unconscious ones, but only with intense monitoring for any signs of electrical activity suggesting consciousness. And 22% wanted entirely new welfare rules specifically for these things.
It shows the public gets the moral gravity, even at the cellular level.
But I saw that reader comment you mentioned, linking it back to Goodall, pointing out the inconsistency. Why cry over brain cells in a dish, but maybe show less concern for, say, animal testing or factory farming?
It does force you to confront those boundaries, doesn't it? Personhood, intelligence. Goodall redefined our view of primates. Now organoids are pushing us to define the limits of engineered life.
And the science is moving so fast from simple cell cultures to these integrated communicating assembloids. Our ethical frameworks just haven't kept up.
Exactly. And that dilemma, that rapid evolution and potential tipping points, that's a perfect segue to the macro scale pressures on our planet's systems.
Okay, yeah. We've got some profoundly worrying news from the North Atlantic. The huge system of rotating currents, the North Atlantic subpolar gyre, it's a critical part of the bigger AMOC.
The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the big conveyor belt.
Right. And that gyre is behaving strangely. Might be nearing a tipping point.
Remind us of the mechanism. It relies on cold, salty surface water sinking deep, right? That drives the flow. Why is it weakening?
Climate change, basically. Two things. Freshwater melt from Greenland dilutes the saltiness, and rising temperatures warm the surface water. Both make the water less dense, so it doesn't sink as effectively. That weakens the cascade, slows the whole gyre.
And they figured this out not just from satellites, but from clamshells.
Yeah, pretty amazing proxy data. 150 years worth from two clam species, Arctica islandica and Glycymerus. Like tree rings, their shells record ocean conditions and growth layers.
And what did the clams reveal?
Two periods of destabilization. One around 1920, probably linked to the recovery after the Little Ice Age ended. But the other, the really alarming one, is the ongoing destabilization that's been accelerating since the 1950s. Driven by human-caused warming.
Okay, so what are the implications if it weakens substantially? We hear about a full AMOC collapse being catastrophic, but just the gyre weakening.
Even just the gyre weakening could mean significantly more extreme weather, especially for Europe. Big changes in global rainfall patterns. And crucially, the sources noted that gyre weakening was a major factor in strengthening the Little Ice Age back from the 13th to 19th centuries.
Which caused widespread famine, societal chaos.
Exactly. We're talking about mechanisms that have historically driven global instability.
Okay, from the ocean to land systems under pressure, Iran. It's now one of the world's most extreme subsidence hotspots. The ground is literally sinking.
Alarmingly fast across huge areas. The cause is unsustainable groundwater extraction, mostly for agriculture. The ground compacts irreversibly.
How big an area are we talking?
An area the size of Maryland, over 12,000 square miles, is sinking faster than 10 millimeters, or about 0.4 inches per year.
And near Rafsanjan, it's over a foot a year because of pistachios.
Over a foot, 34 centimeters per year. Heavy groundwater use for pistachio plantations. It's catastrophic failure.
Affecting hundreds of thousands of people, damaging buildings, roads, creating huge fissures in the land.
Yeah, the structural damage is immense. But the long-term hit to climate resilience is maybe even worse.
How so? Won't the aquifers just refill when it rains again?
Not to the same capacity. The compaction is permanent. The sand and mud particles collapse. It permanently shrinks the aquifer's storage space. So even when rain returns, the region stays vulnerable to drought. It's a permanent loss of that water buffer.
Which connects directly to another water crisis impacting global trade, the Panama Canal.
A huge logistical problem. The canal's locks depend entirely on Lake Gatun, fed by rainfall. And that same lake provides drinking water for over half of Panama's population.
And a single ship transit uses 50 million gallons of water.
50 million gallons. Now, new projections under high emission scenarios show Lake Gatun levels falling significantly. Reduced rainfall, more evaporation.
Meaning a higher chance of those low water levels we saw in 2016 that caused chaos for shipping.
Exactly. The probability of hitting that disruptive low water mark doubles by the end of the century under high emissions. It's linked to warmer Pacific temperatures, changing rainfall patterns, global logistics tied directly to local hydrology.
And these regional crises add up globally, like wildfire smoke. Related deaths in the U.S. could hit 70,000 a year by 2050.
Under a middle-of-the-road warming scenario, yeah. And the economic cost. Stanford estimated it at $608 billion annually. Just from the mortality.
That's more than all other climate damage combined. Storms, agriculture loss.
That's what the study suggests. It highlights how that invisible PM2.5 pollution getting into lungs and bloodstreams is becoming maybe the single most lethal climate impact.
And we're losing geological history, too. Yosemite's glaciers, they've survived since the last ice age 30,000 years ago.
Canoas, McClure, Lyell, Palisade.
Yeah.
They've been there through all of recorded human history in the region.
But they're projected to melt completely within 75 years.
Meaning our generation will likely be the first humans ever to see the Sierra Nevada completely ice-free. It's what scientists call a no-analog scenario. We're creating a climate state with no precedent in our species history there.
Okay, that's sobering. Which brings us to global efforts. China's climate pledges, cutting emissions 7-10% by 2035 under the Paris Agreement.
And when China makes a specific, measurable pledge like that, it carries weight. They tend to hit their big infrastructure targets, like peaking emissions this decade. They're already leaders in deploying renewables.
The sources mentioned a reality-aligned scenario suggesting global CO2 peaking this decade, net zero around 2070, warming peaking just over 2 degrees C if things follow China's track.
It's cautiously optimistic. But the devil's always in the details, isn't it? Like, how much of that 7-10% cut is CO2 versus methane?
Right. Methane's much more potent short-term. Cutting it has a faster impact on warming.
Exactly. And their plan emphasizes reforestation, land use changes. But that scientific scenario, it suggests hitting net zero by 2070 needs massive carbon capture and storage CCS on a scale we just haven't seen yet.
So success hinges not just on solar panels, but on breakthrough negative emissions tech, too.
Seems likely, yeah.
Okay, from those macro systems, let's dive into some really groundbreaking human health and biology stories, starting with, wow, the universal donor kidney.
This is huge for transplant waiting lists. Scientists converted a blood type A kidney to universal type O using enzymes.
Enzymes that clip off those A antigens, the markers that trigger rejection.
Precisely. They then implanted it into a brain-dead recipient to test function.
So the body sees it as type O, but you said the A antigens reappeared after 2 days, so it's temporary.
It is temporary. The conversion isn't permanent. But here's the game. It buys crucial time. You combine this initial enzyme treatment, the ECO kidney, with standard immunosuppression afterwards. It prevents that immediate, violent rejection from the blood type mismatch.
Giving the body time to accept the organ under milder suppression.
Exactly. And this is critical for type O patients over half the waiting list who wait years longer for a match. This could potentially slash those wait times.
That is massive progress. Okay, fertility front. Creating human eggs from skin cells.
A proof of concept, yeah. Using somatic cell nuclear transfer like Dolly the sheep, take a skin cell nucleus, put it in an egg with its nucleus removed, zap it, add drugs to make it shed half its chromosomes.
Creating a functional egg, essentially.
Right.
Which they then fertilized.
Right. The potential is transformative. Better IVF. Maybe options for same-sex couples to have genetically related kids, but the hurdles are immense.
The success rate was tiny, wasn't it?
Extremely low. Only 9% of fertilized eggs reached the blastocyst stage, where they could potentially implant. Most failed due to chromosomal problems, but the big issue was failed gene reprogramming.
Meaning the skin cell nucleus didn't fully switch over to acting like an early embryo cell?
Exactly. Skin cells have DNA locked down for skin functions. Reprogramming means wiping that slate clean, activating early development genes in the right sequence. The failures meant skin cell programming was interfering. It's a massive challenge in molecular control.
And yeah, the ethical questions immediately pop up. Gathering skin cells without consent. Using them to make eggs. Technology way ahead of regulation.
Definitely thorny territory. Right. Okay, moving from cell engineering to toxicology. Snake bites. Huge global health problem. Up to 138,000 deaths a year.
And the challenge is the sheer variety of venoms, right? Needing the right anti-venom for the specific snake.
Which fuels the quest for a universal anti-venom. Jacob Glanville's team at Centivax tried something cool. They sampled blood from Tim Freed, a herpetologist who'd hyper-immunized himself with hundreds of controlled bites.
Using his antibody library to find ones that hit common targets across different snake venom types.
Right. Targeting common binding sites across the 10 main protein classes in venoms, not just one species. And their cocktail of three agents showed broad protection in mice against 19 elapid species cobras, mambas.
So disabling one key component, like the neurotoxins, can neutralize the whole venom.
That's the idea. It shows focused targeting can have broad effects, but not everyone's convinced a true universal antidote is practical.
Like Andreas Lovsenkiel, arguing for cheaper regional anti-venom suites instead.
Yeah, given the Venom complexity, he thinks tailored regional cocktails are more feasible. But both sides agree the future likely involves human monoclonal antibodies, MABs, mass-produced, cheap, targeting specific common toxin classes. That cost effectiveness is key for developing countries.
Okay, shifting to sports medicine and CTE. The new research showing repeated head impacts, even without concussions, raise the risk.
This is critical. It shifts focus from single big hits to the cumulative exposure over years, driving the damage, neuron loss, inflammation. The damage starts earlier and more subtly than we thought.
And the mechanism isn't just neurons dying, it's an inflammation feedback loop.
Exactly. Repeated hits, strained blood vessels, drop oxygen, break down the blood-brain barrier. Harmful stuff leaks in, triggering microglia and astrocytes, the brain's immune and support cells, leading to chronic inflammation. That drives the neurodegeneration of CTE.
Which means policy needs to shift away from just helmets, which aren't enough for these subconcussive hits.
Towards rules reducing unnecessary head impacts in practice for football, soccer, hockey, systemic changes.
Got it. We also have updated guidelines on cannabis use during pregnancy from ACOG.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, yeah. They're strongly recommending abstaining entirely pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy, and lactation.
Because the evidence linking it to problems like preterm birth, low birth weight, NICU admissions, and neurodevelopmental issues like ADHD is getting stronger.
Considerably stronger. And the mechanism is clear. THC crosses the placenta, gets into breast milk. It decreases placental blood flow, restricts oxygen to the fetus very early on, like 5 weeks gestation, disrupting key development.
And their screening advice is interesting, too. Universal screening via self-report, but not biological testing like urine screens.
Right. Because of historical bias. Biological tests had disproportionately impacted minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Black patients, for instance, were 4 to 10 times more likely to get reported to Child Protective Services based on a positive test. ACOG wants non-punitive support and education, not legal trouble.
Makes sense. Okay, last health story. The woman whose massage gun bruising led to a scurvy diagnosis.
Incredible diagnostic journey, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Scurvy. Severe vitamin C deficiency. We think 18th century sailors. Her initial symptoms were baffling transfusion-dependent anemia, high lung pressure, not responding to standard treatments.
So what cracked the case?
A detailed physical exam and really digging into her dietary history. Doctors finally noticed the classic signs. Tiny red spots, corkscrew hairs on her legs, swollen bleeding gums, all signs of capillary fragility from lack of vitamin C needed for collagen. Her restrictive diet lacked fruits and vegetables.
It really underscores how modern malnutrition gets missed because we just don't expect these deficiency diseases anymore and the importance of that dietary history.
Absolutely. But let's end the health section on a high note. The HPV vaccine, huge public health win. New findings show it drives down cervical cancer rates in both vaccinated and unvaccinated people.
That's herd immunity in action, right? Clear evidence.
Crystal clear. Infections covered by the two-valent vaccine dropped 98.4% in vaccinated individuals. But in unvaccinated girls and young women, infections still dropped over 71% because vaccine uptake in the community was so high, 82% vaccinated in the study group.
That's phenomenal. It shows the power of widespread vaccination.
And globally, only about 31% of adolescent girls get one dose currently. If we expand that uptake, we could genuinely eliminate cervical cancer worldwide within a generation.
That's an inspiring thought and a great bridge from recent history and health into deep time, human migration, evolution.
Right. Tackling that classic question, who really discovered America?
Yeah.
And yeah, Columbus in 1492, very late to the party.
The first were indigenous Americans arriving tens of thousands of years ago, bearing land bridge likely. But new footprint evidence from New Mexico pushes that back even further, 21,000 to 23,000 years ago.
During the last glacial maximum, the coldest part of the Ice Age. Surviving then. And there are those controversial findings hinting at presence maybe 130,000 years ago, really challenging migration theories.
And Europeans. Vikings definitely beat Columbus by about 500 years. Lonzo Meadows in Newfoundland.
Leif Erikson, maybe Bjarni Herjolfsson, cited in the Icelandic sagas. But their colonization failed pretty quickly.
Why?
Outnumbered. Hostile relations with the Native Americans they called Skraelings. They just couldn't establish a permanent foothold.
But there's more to early contact. Polynesians and Native Americans.
Hmm?
DNA evidence suggests they met up around 800 years ago.
Yeah. Likely Colombian groups meeting Polynesians. Supported by botany, too. The sweet potato, native to the Americas, found in ancient Polynesian sites, suggests Polynesian voyages to South America, transoceanic contact way before Europeans.
And Columbus. He insisted it was Asia, mostly for the titles and wealth Spain promised, though maybe he knew better later.
Possibly. His later writings called the Americas a paradise, a new region, suggests he recognized its novelty, whatever his public stance was for his patrons.
Okay, human evolution, usually it's all about bigger brains. But Homo floresiensis, the hobbits, they flipped that script.
Tiny hominins from Indonesia, up to 60,000 years ago. Chimp-sized brains, only about 420 cubic centimeters.
And researchers use tooth size, right? Smaller wisdom teeth usually correlate with bigger brains across Homo species.
Encephalization, yeah.
Yeah.
But the hobbits, small teeth, tiny brains. The exception.
And that clue helped figure out their dwarfism, insular nanism.
Right. It suggests they evolved from a larger ancestor by slowing childhood growth, keeping juvenile traits, adapting to limited island resources without a huge cognitive hit.
That's the key, isn't it? Tiny brains, but still capable. Made tools. Hunted dwarf elephants. Brain volume doesn't strictly equate to intelligence or complexity.
Exactly. Okay, jump to Saudi Arabia. Massive discovery. 12,000-year-old life-sized camel etchings in the no-food desert. Monumental rock art.
12,000 years ago. That's way earlier than previous evidence for humans in northern Arabia, right? By 2,000 years.
Precisely. Shows survival and culture in harsh conditions much earlier. These huge camel carvings probably acted as waymarkers.
Guiding people to temporary oases during a wetter period.
Yeah, between 16,000 and 13,000 years ago, the desert was briefly grassland. Now, the cultural links or fascinating tools found nearby are typical of the Natufian culture from the Levant.
Suggesting contact across hundreds of kilometers, an interconnected ancient landscape.
Right. Now, for a different kind of archaeology, digitally unmasking Colombian mummies.
Using CT scans to see the skull beneath the masks, then reconstructing the faces?
Exactly. Using software to superimpose soft tissue based on average facial depth data from modern Colombians. So not exact portraits, but realistic representations of what they could have looked like.
Got it. Ancient treasures next. Over 1,000 gold and silver coins recovered from the 1715 Treasure Fleet shipwreck off Florida.
Fleet, yeah. 11 Spanish ships, maybe $400 million in treasure today's value, sunk by a hurricane heading back to Spain.
And the haul was mostly silver reales, pieces of eight, and some gold escudos, minted in Mexico, Peru, Bolivia.
Physical evidence of that massive wealth transfer from the Americas to Europe.
Okay, two quick final historical notes. The ancient Egyptian Messi statue.
Yeah, nobleman found at Socorro, nicknamed Messi because he's huge compared to the woman and girl with him. Size equals importance in their art.
And it's unique combining 3D carving with high relief.
Only known example from the Old Kingdom, yeah. Architecturally significant.
And finally, ant yogurt.
Anthropological experiment. Recreating a traditional Balkan recipe. Adding live redwood ants to warm milk overnight.
And the ants introduce bacteria, like from sourdough plus formic acid from their venom.
From Delectobacillus sanfranciscensis, yeah.
Yeah.
Gives it a tangy, herbaceous taste. They served it as an antwich at a Michelin restaurant.
An antwich, but with a strong warning not to try this at home due to parasites.
Definitely a necessary warning. Okay, from ants to the cosmos. Final section. Deep space discoveries, starting with Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Now considered highly habitable, Cassini found more evidence, molecular building blocks for life.
Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen detected in fresh ice grains ejected from the subsurface ocean, not just weathered surface ice.
Meaning the chemicals are readily available in the ocean itself. Liquid water, energy source, chemical toolkit. It has everything.
It seems to. Which raises the stakes, as the scientists noted. If life isn't found there, with all the right conditions.
It makes you question why life didn't emerge there. Challenges our basic understanding.
Exactly. Speaking of surprises out there, JWST spotted the farting dwarf planet Makemake in the Kuiper Belt.
Farting methane gas, detected by fluorescence at incredibly cold temperatures.
Minus 387 Fahrenheit.
Right, yeah.
It challenges the view of Makemake as totally frozen and dead. It's dynamic, like Pluto. Only the second object out there known to produce its own gas.
So is it an atmosphere or plumes? Outgassing.
Scientists aren't sure yet. Could be a fragile atmosphere or active plumes like Enceladus, suggesting internal activity. Still a mystery.
Okay, closer to home, our galactic center. Sagittarius A, the supermassive black hole. New models of stars that just barely escape it.
Partial tidal disruption events. The black hole strips off their outer layers. They can lose up to 60% of their mass but survive. Become survivor stars.
And that violence changes them. Makes them swell, glow brighter.
Up to 10 times brighter for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And the stretching dredges up helium and nitrogen from the core to the surface, creates a unique chemical fingerprint we can detect.
And this might explain the mystery G objects near the Galactic Center.
That's the leading theory now. These swollen, short-lived survivors fit the description of those puzzling, cloudy G objects. It helps us track the black hole's feeding habits over time.
Interesting. Now for a disappearing act. Our asteroid belt is slowly losing mass.
About 0.0088% of its mass annually, according to new calculations. It's Jupiter's fault, really.
Its gravity stops a planet forming, causes collisions instead.
Right. Destabilizes orbits, leads to high-speed impacts that grind asteroids down. About 20% of the debris heads inwards, potential Earth impactors. The other 80% becomes dust, feeding the zodiacal cloud.
And looking back, the belt was 50% more massive 3.5 billion years ago, matching the decline in impacts on Earth and the Moon.
Exactly. Confirms the belt isn't static, it's a dynamic, self-destructing system.
Okay, quick galactic dynamics note. A huge, mysterious wave rippling through the Milky Way, vertically.
Yeah, affecting stars 30,000 to 65,000 light years out, pushing billions of stars up and down like a swell. Astronomers think maybe a past collision with a dwarf galaxy triggered it. Still figuring it out.
And we end back on Earth with weather, the Fujiwara dance. Hurricane Humberto pulling tropical storm Imelda.
Yeah, a rare interaction where the stronger storm steers the weaker one. In this case, swinging Imelda away from the east coast.
So it spares the southeast from the worst rain, but still dangerous conditions expected.
Definitely. Heavy rain, life-threatening rip currents from Florida up the coast. Still a major event, just less catastrophic than a direct hit from Imelda would have been.
So we started this deep dive thinking about Jane Goodall's legacy, connecting it to AI ethics, deepfakes, mini-brains.
Journeying through tech solutions for AI heat. The fragility of Earth systems like the Atlantic Gyre and sinking land in Iran.
Balanced against human ingenuity, universal kidneys, making eggs from skin cells.
Right. And what stands out, connecting deep history and space. This idea that plate tectonics, Earth's geology, is maybe essential for complex life.
Yet right now, we're seeing Yosemite's ancient glaciers disappear for the first time in human history there.
So it raises this final question for you, the listener. How much of the stable geology that shaped us and sustains us is truly unique, truly irreplaceable? And how fast are we pushing ourselves into a totally new planetary state, one with no historical precedent?
Something to think about. Keep digging into these fascinating complexities.
Yeah.
Until the next deep dive, thank you for joining us.
We'll see you soon.